Welcome, everyone. This is Module 6, which is called Lojong, Cultivating Compassion. And this is Talk 2, Absolute Bodhicitta. And it's actually the first half of Absolute Bodhicitta, because we will take 2 weeks on that. So we have an issue of some people. Who was here last week, please? Okay, and then other people were not. So
that would be right.
So there's a bit of catch-up, because Lojong, which you may not have even heard of, has a lot of continuity to it. And if you really want to do the practice, it's going to be necessary to do some kind of catch-up. But you may not want to do the practice. So it's kind of up to you how you relate to it. The practice is something you might choose to do, and if you do, it will take a very definite decision and some effort. So before telling you what Lojong is, I want to talk for a minute about bodhicitta. How many people are familiar with that word? Fair number, okay. So, the heart of the Lojong teachings is training in bodhicitta. And we will get back to what Lojong is in a minute. But bodhicitta is the seed of enlightenment which every one of us has. It is within us the capability of waking up and becoming an enlightened Buddha. And whether or not we recognize it or are familiar with it within ourselves, every one of us has it. It's not possible not to have bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is calling us to wake up, whether we know it or not. I want to talk just for a second about what it means to be a bodhisattva. Probably most of you have heard that word, right? Some have not. So a bodhisattva is a fully awakened being. That the word bodhisattva means awake being, bodhisattva. A bodhisattva radiates joy and compassion effortlessly like the sun. A bodhisattva can't stop being compassionate and radiating compassion. Bodhisattvas are the compassion of a bodhisattva radiates like the sun. The sun radiates everywhere. It doesn't shut down. You can also say that a bodhisattva is a courageous warrior who has transcended fear, which doesn't experience fear. It means is not stopped or limited by fear. And a fully realized bodhisattva has the skill, the strength, the power, the knowledge, the wisdom to effectively act in the world. It's not an amateurish thing. It's not a sloppy or unskilled thing. The bodhisattva knows how to be a bodhisattva. So bodhicitta, to get back to that, is the seed within us which we can ripen on the path to being a bodhisattva. The bodhicitta is there if we want to nourish it, we can take the seed, we can water it, provide fertilizer for it, and let it mature within us, which takes work but is also very joyful. So right now we are not fully realized bodhisattvas, any of us, but we can aspire to be bodhisattvas. We can't do this by just talking ourselves into it. We actually have to take a good look at where we are right now and start to work on ourselves. And if we do that, indeed we are on the path to becoming bodhisattvas. And the most practical way to do this is to train in arousing bodhicitta. Now, with any training, there are, of course, various protocols and regimens for doing it. For instance, if you want to do strength training, there are various places you could go, various programs and so on. And this is true for arousing bodhicitta, for training in bodhicitta. For example, a different one than the one we practice here can be found in Zen. Koan training is very much a way of bringing out the bodhicitta in us, rousing it so that we can become enlightened bodhisattvas. But what we're doing here is called Lojong. It's a tradition of at least 1,000 years and has been continuously transmitted by our teachers to us, and I talked about that last week. So this is the training you get if you hang out here. So we have actually lots of time. Does anyone want to raise any issues or ask any questions about that?
Sure.
Yeah.
You said that none of us in here is a bodhisattva. Who would be an example of a bodhisattva?
Well, I think that my teacher was. I think that his teacher was. There are examples. They aren't all that common in the world. Sometimes there are what you might call bodhisattvas in various other traditions. It's not a matter of being a Buddhist. But there are people who have completely put the awakening of others, the relieving of suffering of others, before their own wish to get out of suffering. And that's what a bodhisattva means, regardless of how you're doing it, whether you're doing it in a religious tradition or whatever. A bodhisattva, simply without even having to think about it, works to relieve other people of suffering rather than saying, how do I get out of suffering myself? And we can... Yes?
Oh, I have an example I thought of was this book I read. It's called Mountains Beyond Mountains. And it's about a doctor. His last name's Farmer, but I can't remember his first name. Paul. And he learned Haitian, and he went to Haiti, and it's an amazing story of someone who literally just against all odds set up medical clinics, and he literally helped people build houses and whatever they needed. So it's an amazing story, and I thought right away when I read it that this is a real bodhisattva in the world. I mean, he gave his life to that and started an organization, foundation. So it made many ripples all the way to Peru and all these other places, working with really poor people.
I could also suggest, as Trungpa Rinpoche did, that it's not restricted to only the typical or the traditional notions of doing good. It's not like Florence Nightingale is the only path for a bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, someone who only works in a medical field or in a philanthropic field, or it has to do with all kinds of aspects of life. And one of the things, another aspect of life which was brought up, which was very interesting, that Trungpa Rinpoche brought up, was culture. Is that people who work in culture, they elevate people's minds and to help them actually achieve an awakened state. It doesn't have to be called that, but I mean, that's basically what effectively it is, to raise people's levels of being through introducing them to experiences through cultural aspects. He talked about artists and musicians and people like that as a possibility of where bodhisattva activity could work. So we have, it's many, many things. You know, there are many people who can be bodhisattvas in many different ways. There's no just program. But as Michael will point out, and as Padma does here, the fundamental thing that we're looking at here is mind training. So that if we can train our mind, which is what Lojong means, then basically
we'll get to that.
Yeah, that's the path, and then you can become available.
All right, thank you.
So in the text we're using by Padma Chodron, she says there are three things we need in order to practice Lojong, the training in arousing bodhicitta. First of all, we need to tame and stabilize the mind by practicing shamatha, peaceful abiding, and vipassana, insight meditation. So this is the meditation we do in the first hour of sitting. It's shamatha meditation is attaining peace, but it doesn't mean going into a state of glowing happiness and comfort. It means being present and allowing our mind to experience what it is and attaining peace in that way. So this is very essential. Without this as a foundation, we can't do the training. So this is called taming as opposed to training. If you wanted to work with a wild horse, you would first have to tame the horse so that the horse is calm enough in order to be trained. Otherwise, the horse is not accessible to training. So the second thing we need to do this particular practice is training in the 59 slogans in the root text, which you have in front of you in one way or another. And that is, it is a training because we actually are going to use our minds to put it together, and it has definite structure to it. And the third thing is the training in Tonglen, which we're not going to get to today, but we will in a couple of weeks. So we're not going to discuss that right now. So there's 3 points here. The mind has to be tamed as a foundation. We're going to train by contemplating these slogans in various ways. And we're going to practice Tonglen, which actually puts together the meditation and the contemplation. So last week, we worked on the first of the 59 slogans, which is called First Train in the Preliminaries. And the preliminaries are joyful to have such a human birth, difficult to find, free and well-favored. Death is real and comes without warning. This body will be a corpse. Unalterable are the laws of karma. Cause and effect cannot be escaped. Samsara is an ocean of suffering, unendurable, unbearably intense. So I would like to hear from the people who were here last week and are here this week, if you experimented with working with that slogan and what you experienced.
Gratitude. It's such a great reminder that just crystallize those things and what they mean to you.
Did you work on all four of them, or just successively, or different days? How did you do it?
I did it by actually first internalizing them. For me, each one can be summarized by something. The first one, good fortune to be born human so that we have the opportunity to, you know, lessen our suffering. Second one, impermanence, is kind of what reminds me of impermanence. Third, cause and effect. It starts with the mind, with the thoughts, kind of the seeds that you're planting. And the fourth one, I would say I have the most difficulty with, because it's difficult to understand, fully grasp that, you know, we're in samsara, and, you know, you can see it happening all over, but there's just this vastness. I mean, that's why we meditate, to see just how open things really are. So it brings me into a state of gratitude.
Anyone else? Particularly, the issue was raised on the fourth one. Does anyone want to comment on that?
I wasn't here.
It's okay, but you can.
I listened to it online.
Yes.
And I was, you know, kind of listening along, and I'm getting in. And then when you said that samsara actually increases as we progress along the path, I found myself going, what? Like, you know, that threw me a little bit, you know. So I was thinking, like, you know, progressing along the path is progressing, you know, towards more awakening and enlightenment. And so to say that samsara actually increases as we progress along the path was a little bit of a curveball for me.
I don't think samsara increases. I think our ability to experience it increases because we're not hiding it.
Or the awareness of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're that's what being aware is. We actually need samsara and stupidity and confusion to wake up. That's part of what we're going to explore further down the road here, is actually that's so that it's not like there's not more samsara than there was before you started meditating, by any means. But your understanding of it increases, and your perception and sensitivity to it does.
It's like thinking when we sit down and meditate that all of a sudden meditation makes us have more thoughts. But in fact, we're just noticing that's what we have, a lot of thoughts. So it's in the same way. You start to see it more.
Listen, I was doing this sort of studying it after I finished meditation as law four. And the comment you made about how when we're underwater, we don't realize what it would be like to breathe fresh air. And so that, it would really, like, ooh. I think that point of, you notice it more when you think, like, oh, yeah, but there's a lot of this stuff that's really hard. And the way you keep yourself going is like, oh, it's not so bad. Otherwise, you'd feel bad. And that second one about, you know, I would actually, as I said, this body would be a corpse. I'd pick parts of my body to just sort of do that, like this. Mm-hmm. And even think about, like, when I've seen you know, people in coffins, like, oh, someday he'll be. Except I won't do that, but they could be. I'm not bad enough.
You can't attend your own funeral.
No, but you can say, I don't want to have people have to look at my dead body. It's not my tradition, so it's
not. Okay.
I thought a lot about just that word ocean in relation to suffering. And, you know, the ocean is such a vast gigantic, big thing. I think oftentimes, I know my own suffering is pretty vast and big and complicated and multifaceted. But when I think about it from like just that visual imagery of what an ocean is, and thinking about being in this kind of ocean of suffering, it looks different from different perspectives. Like, and even within the course of a week, there are different. It feels different, you know. Like sometimes I thought of like what's it like to be on the bottom of the ocean, just kind of looking up at all the shit that's around. And what's it like when the water gets really, really choppy and kind of tosses you around? And what's it like to kind of poke your head up out and just kind of look at everything from a different angle? So I try to think of it kind of in that metaphorical way of looking at and experiencing suffering from different angles and what it looks like from different perspectives.
Right, and as we progress, we're going to become less insulated. Therefore, we're going to feel everyone else's suffering more intensely, too.
Oh, good.
Isn't that wonderful? Okay.
I'm new to these reminders, as stated. I have to say that it may be my state of mind, but I feel like here is February. And the only one that has a little bit of for me of an upward journey is the first one, but if that it's, you know, it's reminding me that hey, get glad. But yeah, it feels kind of overwhelming.
Okay, so now we have to get to the very heart of the Lojong practice, which is training in bodhicitta. So does everyone have a root text in some form or other to look at or share?
Well, I have more copies here.
Yeah, let me pass that.
Well, I already have two.
Okay, share them if you need to.
Oh, wait. Someone can be fine, too.
You guys have one. You have one. Who else wants?
I'll give this one myself.
Okay, so point two is the main practice, which is training in bodhicitta. And if we look at it, we see that it's divided into two parts, which are called absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. And we're going to take our time with this because point two and the slogans in it are really the heart of the teaching. If you want to do the practice, you really have to work on those. You can't skip them. After that, it becomes a little, we're over a certain hump, we're actually into it and can work in a more relaxed way with it. So this is very important, if you really want to do it, to follow it through completely. So the first five of these, which are numbered 2 to 6, are absolute bodhicitta, and the next ones are relative bodhicitta. So what does that mean? And rather than explain it, I'm actually going to read from a text. This is another book we put on the website. The Practice of Lojong, Cultivating Compassion Through Training the Mind. And this is by Tralek Rinpoche. I'm going to read. The cultivation of bodhicitta, or an enlightened heart, has two aspects and two associated practices, absolute and relative. The traditional Mahayana analogy for the spiritual path is that it requires two wings to accomplish just as a bird needs two wings to fly. the wings of wisdom and compassion. You could define absolute bodhicitta as the wisdom mind and relative bodhicitta as the cultivation of a compassionate heart. While relative and absolute bodhicitta are ultimately inseparable, it is important that we first learn to distinguish them. The Lojong teachings are predominantly concerned with the cultivation of relative bodhicitta, but we should never forget that absolute bodhicitta is the main frame of reference and therefore the basis of our training. The cultivation of compassion is the veritable heart of the Lojong teachings. Compassion is not just about alleviating the suffering of others. It is also a powerful tool for effecting our own spiritual transformation. We must learn to be compassionately concerned about others, because that concern is what enables us to go beyond our discursive thoughts, our conflicting emotions, kleshas, and self-obsessions, and break down the barriers created by ignorance, prejudice, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Absolute bodhicitta, on the other hand, is our authentic and original state of mind, and therefore relates to the wisdom aspect of enlightenment. Despite the fact that sentient beings experience a multitude of delusions and obscurations, an element of the mind remains uncorrupted. There is an open, empty, clear, spacious, and luminous clarity of mind that is beyond concepts, ideas, or sensations. It is the practice of compassion that leads to the actualization of the wisdom mind, for while the practice of relative bodhicitta does not cause enlightenment, it does help to lift the veils and remove the conflicting emotions that create obstacles to permanently actualizing the ever-present condition of absolute bodhicitta. Realizing the state of innate wakefulness also gives rise to the understanding that relative bodhicitta and absolute bodhicitta are really two aspects of the same thing. So at this point, we're going to have a very brief practice of flashing absolute bodhicitta, and Emily is going to instruct it.
Okay, so this is actually meditation practice, so if you can sit up, and it's good if you can, you can put your feet flat on the floor, and if you need to come more to the edge of the chair, like me, I'm short, so I need to come forward, so your feet are comfortably placed. So this is a different practice than we've been doing before, though it's definitely an aspect of meditation practice. So we're going to have our eyes open and going to look straight out. And if you can look between someone rather than at them, I'm facing an empty chair, which is, that's why I moved. So just see if you can find a space between people so you're not staring at someone in their face. So begin by feeling the posture upright. Eyes open. And look straight out. And now, just relax into the space. Just let go. Let go of thought. Just relax. There's no object of meditation. You're not using your breath as an object of meditation. It's a completely simple practice. There's really nothing to do, which makes it hard. It's just resting in space. And if your mind wanders, you just come back to the space. There's nothing, you're not labeling thoughts, labeling thinking. You're not using the breath as an object of meditation. You're just resting in the space. And that's a summary of the absolute bodhicitta practice.
Thank you. We have two slogans to work with today. There are five absolute bodhicitta slogans. We're going to take our time with them. We're going to do two today, and then Michael is going to guide us in three more of them next week. So the first of these is regard all dharmas as dreams. So all dharmas means everything we experience. It means our thoughts, our emotions, any body feelings, any physical sensations, anything we can perceive, any situation which appears to us in the environment. So nothing in our experience can be excluded from all dharmas. Regard all dharmas as dreams. So no corner of our life is not part of all dharmas, everything we could possibly experience. So regarding everything as a dream does not mean that everything is sleepy, fuzzy, vague, or indefinite. Quite the opposite. Regarding everything as dreams means that everything is more vivid, more intense, experienced fully without a conceptual overlay. And it might be helpful to think of it as regard all dharmas or regard all experiences as cinema. When we watch a movie, what goes on there can be very intense. It can be intensely joyful. It could be intensely relaxing. It could be intensely painful, frightening, amusing. All kinds of things can happen, all kinds of experiences. But when we watch a movie, the one thing we don't have is, it's happening to me. And regarding all dharmas as dreams means regarding them as not being owned by a me. That is, all these experiences are happening, they're very vivid. But if we look for any owner of the experience, who are they happening to? We have this idea that they're happening to me, but we can't find that me. If we could find that me, it would mean something that's not part of what we experience. So we couldn't possibly experience it. In other words, there's no owner to what happens, is the basic idea. If you think about... Yeah?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. There's no what to what happens?
Owner.
Owner.
There's no owner to what we experience. We can experience pain. But if we say it's my pain, then there's someone owning the pain. Or my pleasure. And it doesn't matter what the experience is. Good, bad, evil, happy, philanthropic, amused, detailed, technically interesting. All experiences are happening vividly, and we can't find an owner behind it. So this is the actual contemplation on regard all dharmas as dreams. We believe there's a continuous narrative, but when you think about it, the only reason there seems to be a continuous narrative in our life of what's happening is because of memory. If we didn't remember anything, there'd be no continuity. But we can only remember in the present. We can't remember in the past. If we're remembering anything that happened to us, we are remembering it now. And if we're anxious about the future, planning the future, thinking about the future, again, all these thoughts about the future can only happen now. They aren't happening in the future. So everything is happening, or nothing's happening, whatever you want to say it, but we can't find ownership to it. Anyone want to discuss that?
It makes me think of that movie, Memento. You know, where the guy...
I don't know.
He doesn't have... he's lost his ability to make memories.
Mm-hmm.
And something terrible has happened. And so what he has to do is he actually takes ink and puts, like, tattoos it on himself to try to remember. And the movie is told that you started... Yeah, sort of at the end, and the next scene, sort of like, here's the last piece. It starts back here, and then it runs into this. Mm-hmm. And it keeps going back and back. But it's, he's only, he literally is right there.
So it makes us doubt our take on reality, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Makes me think of Alzheimer's.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
Dementia. And how that's apparently a rising epidemic worldwide, and it's people get terrified of that, understandably. And you can lose yourself.
Yeah, right.
Because you have no memory.
And some people can get very anxious about it, and some people can get more peaceful about it. It's interesting.
I don't know if I said this before.
Pardon?
I don't know if I've said this before because my memory's not good. I actually had sustained a concussion at the end of January, and my memory wasn't great before that, but now it's funk. And, you know, it's hard for me to remember what I did yesterday. And, you know, what you just said about, you know, for some people it makes them anxious and for others it makes them more peaceful, I think. For me, in a large way, because I've been taken out of work, so and I live alone, it's easy to be a lot more peaceful about it. You know, I think originally it, you know, made me more anxious because I thought, like, what am I supposed to be remembering that I'm not remembering? But having been out of work now for a couple of weeks and kind of calming down, it's sort of kind of a calming place to not be able to remember things, because you really do. I mean, my memory isn't, you know, Alzheimer's. It's not, you know, it's not that bad, but it's definitely compromised, and it definitely has put me much more in a live in the moment place, because I can't remember what somebody told me this morning or what I did yesterday or whatever.
Well, you got here. That's great.
I did.
Okay.
Just having some trouble with the concept. In some ways, it feels like you're experiencing life at a distance, as opposed to, it almost seems contradictory to the four reminders. It seemed like you're supposed to be joyful, to be alive, and remembering the suffering, and yeah, so it's sort of like, you're, one hand you're bringing it close in your experience, and at the other hand you're pushing it away.
Well, I don't think we're pushing experience away. We're saying that we can't find an owner of the experience.
That seems like you're, if you're not acknowledging that some of it, if I'm not acknowledging that this is my experience in some ways, then it feels hard to be grateful for it.
Well, if it's an enjoyable experience, you could be grateful. Actually, if it's a bad experience, you could be grateful, but you can't find someone to own it, that's all. Because that would be beyond the experience. It would have to be something up outside of your life.
I guess that maybe I'm taking the cinema or the movie thing too literally, because it just seems like you're pushing.
Well, don't forget we're talking about the absolute and the relative. So this is really, it's hard to get because they seem contradictory somehow, but they are actually joined together.
Okay.
So, but we can have to, we have to talk about them in separate ways.
Okay.
So that's why the chart is really helpful. And it, it does seem, I almost like, I know it's sort of like you never do this, but I thought, why don't we just start with the relative and get to the absolute later, you know? And it's like they never start there. They always start with the absolute.
There's a really good reason.
And I was, I was completely shot down.
Michael would have shot us if we had skipped the absolute.
Go ahead,
Michael.
So we're going to do it. Because he's going to get his turn next week.
Okay, just give him a chance.
If we just basically go back to what we've been doing, I mean, admittedly, if you're just coming in here from the street fresh, never, what am I doing? All dharmas are dreams. What do you mean it's joyful human birth and, you know, life is miserable and blah, blah, blah. We've been following a path of understanding the fundamental problem. And we've been leading to at least a point of understanding the possibility of seeing no ego. We can actually understand how ego is a total fiction. It's a complete habit. It's nothing to itself. There's nothing to it at all. And we have to start experiencing that directly so that when we read or we go through this reminder, the first reminder of joyful, precious human birth, free and well-favored, it means we've encountered the Dharma. We've encountered reality. And it's a very great thing, something wonderful. I mean, everybody is born. And just because you're born as a human is not the reason for cause for rejoice. It's actually the fact that we can wake up. We actually understand we've encountered the possibility of waking up as opposed to just grinding away and again, churning over again and again, endlessly repeating ourselves in terms of and living out our fickle mind. So... that's what we're talking about. We have to go back. Bring everything with you when you come to these points. That's important. Mm-hmm. Try to like understand how we're on a journey together here. I mean, I'm on a journey anyway for myself. I'm hoping we're all exploring this together. But we are individual as well. So there is a process here. We didn't want to start with this if we hadn't started somehow further back with the fundamental problem. Understanding shamatha vipassana, as Michael brought up, we have to tame the mind first. Without taming the mind, we'll never be able to train it. So if we're just prey to, well, I'm thinking, therefore I am doing our little thing, and it's all me, you know, we'll never get to that point of being able to pop it. We can't get to it because we can't really stop the seed. We can't stop the thought process. And so... You know, all of this which we're doing is like it is a sequential. It's a progression.
I just realized that one of my issues is I always bristle at anything that is an absolute.
Anything that is an absolute.
That's good.
Yeah, good. That's great.
That's excellent.
That's juicy.
Yeah, that's excellent. So now we've got to tighten screws a little bit. Wonderful. Okay.
We want her to come back. Don't do that.
Yeah. Oh, you'll come back.
Okay, go ahead.
So the second one is... sorry, I lost my place now. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. This is the second one we're going to do today. So what Pema calls this is pulling out the rug. So if we think we understand the previous slogan, because we say, oh... There's really no me behind it, or we have some idea, we've made some sense of the first one, well, then we better think again. If we think everything is going on in our mind, well, then where's that mind? We could look for it not only our experience, but the mind that's experiencing. We can't find mind either. And, in fact, we don't have anything to stand on. All our ideas about who we are, what our life is, what we're about, what makes life meaningful. It's the biggest identity theft ever. And it can cause panic and fear. It definitely, if you actually start to get a sniff of this, you get a sense of panic. And that means it's starting to work. So I'm going to describe, if you don't mind, a brief experience of how I got a big whiff of it. And it was in a month-long meditation retreat, which is a group retreat, and it's pretty strict. You work as a group, you do a lot of meditating, you don't chit-chat. The talking is what's called functional talking. You only talk to sort out who's going to do the dishes or necessary things. You don't gossip, you don't start to work on activities that are in the outside world because you've wrapped them up and put them aside for the month. And then halfway through it, there's a rest day. This is how Trungpa Rinpoche did it. There's a rest day, no meditating today, no rules, do whatever you want, have a party, drink lots of alcohol, dance. Rules are different today. So I actually did have a fair amount of alcohol, and then I was by myself, and the bottom dropped out, and it didn't drop out just in one flash. It kept going on and on and on. And it's very hard to put into words, but basically there was no ground. Not in the physical sense. I was sitting in my tent and the earth wasn't dissolving, but there's no ground. There's no basis whatsoever. And by the way, we don't try to provoke such experiences if people don't have a practice of shamatha meditation. Your shamatha meditation is very important because you've learned that you can sit through whatever your mind dishes up and not freak out and run off. This is such important training if we're going to go into this. We don't give it to people who haven't committed to that, and we certainly don't give it to people who are psychotic or in some other way unable to hold their life at all and are confused about even their conventional self. So that was my experience of it. And you might encounter, I don't know what you'll encounter if you do it. The way you work with a contemplation is you choose a time to do it. And you can sit down, be quiet for a little while, based some basic, you don't have to do it too long, but establish your quiet place. Then take up the contemplation. You're not using your breath now. You're using the words of the contemplation. Regard all dharmas as dreams. And if your thoughts wander, you come back to regard all dharmas as dreams. You let your mind absorb that. You let it think about the implications. You don't expect you're going to get an answer, but you're allowed to bring whatever thinking is directly related to it and work with it for a while. And then you put the contemplation aside. So you're using your mind in discursively in a contemplation as opposed to a pure meditation where our training is to go back to an object like the breath. So we can have a little discussion of that. We seem to have more time, fortunately. Pulling out the rug.
What was it like? Was this month where did you have, was it a real interruption from your daily life to just take a month long retreat?
Oh yeah, Emily did a 3-year retreat.
Yeah,
although it was a rather busy one in terms of practices. But we've all done this at least once, maybe more than once. What was it like? Well, you come in certainly with a very busy mind, just the way you came in today, right? Tomorrow I got to do this, blah, 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 right? We all have a lot of business. But here we've arranged basically to say, I've set my affairs aside. Yes, I will have a job to go back to, or no job to go back to, or my family to go back to, but during this month, I have no obligation. So then your mind just kind of gives up on all the crap. You can only go over chewing your cud so much. It starts to, oh, I've seen that before. I've been through that thought. And yeah, that's one of those. Yeah, that's one of those. And there aren't that many of them. They're so repetitive that you just have much more quieting if you take a long time. It's a great thing to do if you can do it. And all you need is to be able to do it, to make the commitment for a week or a month or whatever and say, I'm going to do that. It will move your meditation to a new place, for sure. Everyone agrees with that who's done it? Mm-hmm. Yes?
When you said that the bottom fell out for you, were you talking about because nothing belonged to you that your identity was just washed away?
Well, it didn't mean that I couldn't think, okay? I mean, I knew my name. I knew where my home was located that I was going to go back to when the retreat was over. It wasn't that I had amnesia or anything. No. It's not so easy to put words to.
Is it more like a sense of your identity as this, this, and this? There's some sense of losing that solidification?
Yeah, it no longer provides the orientation that it did, the security it did.
If there were any security at all, which so part of what we do is we look at where our thoughts come from. This is what we're doing, and how we discover this groundlessness is just simply continuing to inquire. You know, as we meditate, we're using our meditation practice as the basis for this. So when we talk about contemplating the nature of unborn insight, we're actually our unborn awareness. We're looking at actually. Establishing this in meditation, that is actually something that can we need to, and we don't only have to be on the meditation cushion when we do this. It doesn't have to only be in a formal setting. But when we look at our thoughts come up, when we see our thoughts come up, when we look where they come from, we simply look where they come from. We find out if there's an owner. Is there a beginning? Is there a middle? Is there an end? Does it have a color? Does it have a size, a shape, a texture? Any of these things. Can we actually find it? And when we actually look for all these things, even though we're completely swallowed up in them, we can't find them. And when we continue looking for the so-called me, that's the hardest one. I mean, nobody's ever found their mind. There's a famous expression that all the Buddhas in the universe who have ever spent all their time in examining never be able to find mind. You know, you can't find mind, and yet it's everywhere and in everything. So it's like recognizing this fundamental insight it can come very gradually, it can come very dramatically. As Michael is expressing, but it can also just be leaking through a drop at a time, you know, mm-hmm. And it starts to get weaker and weaker, this whole notion of solid world, and, you know, after a while it starts to get more transparent, and, you know, then it becomes off and on, and we'll see our minds flickering in and out of, you know, relaxing and being open and tightening up, you know, and going to this thing about, oh, this is real, you know. really getting heavy about this stuff. So that's part of our journey is to actually explore that. But, I mean, this is fundamental. This is something we all can find out for ourselves. This is not some level of high attainment. It's actually present in front of everybody. And it's only scary, or it's more of a shock, I'd say.
Well, that's pulling out the rug.
Yeah,
the shock. If you really visualize what that's like, if you're on the rug and it's pulled out, you know, there's this, like, everything's kind of thrown up in the air and you don't know where you are anymore. There's a quality of sudden surprise. I mean, but this doesn't have to always be like that. But there's a sense of a big space of what?
Jungang Kongtrul was a lama who died about in the 90s. He was a really wonderful teacher. But he spoke pretty good English, and he said that one way to sort of understand or experience it, or think about it, because we've all taken airplane rides, is when the airplane is just going off the ground, just as it leaves the ground, there's this moment where it's just, you know, before you actually are aloft. I mean, you actually are just at that moment of ascension. And he says you can actually catch that right there, that same sense of just, you know, oh, everything stops. I mean, there's just somehow nobody there. It's just, or if you get in an accident, you know, you're heading towards what appears to be sudden death. If you've been in accidents like that, you know, your mind just goes stop completely and you're right there. Those are sometimes dramatic moments when, or heightened moments when that kind of experience can come through. But I mean, it's fundamental. It's just here all over. It's just all the time.
And, Michael, do you have some help?
No, thank you.
Oh.
Yeah. Just the assignment. If you really want to follow this, if you look on our website, there are some recommendations. First of all, make sure, if you haven't done so, you heard Emily's last talk from the previous module and the talk I gave last week, and review this if you need to. Make sure you have the materials, the slogans. And last week's assignment was contemplating the four reminders. So this week's assignment is, again, contemplation. Actually, there's two things. Contemplation of these two slogans. And Michael will go on with three more of them to pull the rug out even further next week. And I think he'll do an excellent job on that. And also, Emily showed you the flashing of awareness. You can do that at the start of meditation. You can take your seat and just settle into your meditation and do what she's suggested, straight out. Drop the technique, or don't use the technique of the breath for a moment. Just be there. Just be present. See how spacious that is. And it's hard to hold that for very long. And then you can do your sitting meditation. Is that a fair summary?
Are there any questions on that?
Just like for a couple of minutes?
Yeah, could be short, you know.
Could be a couple of seconds.
Yeah, it's a flash. It's really a flash. Is like a flash. It's just, you know, like...
Flash.
You can also do that if you're at work and you just look out the window, if you have a window, you know, and just stop and just let that be. You can punctuate your experience here in all situations. Start with a formal situation, just so you actually make sure you're doing it right and can actually register. You know, you start to get familiar, and then as you go on, you can actually increase the frequency in different situations so that it becomes much more familiar and established. You know, you're connected with it, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that phrase before, I guess it's just how you connect words, like when I said that's food. I had this idea that, like, suddenly you had this great vision of yourself as a bodhisattva. Like, there was some visual that went with it, because of that word flash.
No, it has to be completely simple. It's not a story of now I've turned myself into a god.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. No, I mean, just sort of, like, you know, there's this sudden, like...
Yeah.
Oh, the flash itself.
A visual.
Oh.
Like
the flash bulb. Oh, I get it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So I didn't use... Michael used that word flash, and that is actually Chogyam Trungpa's words, too. But I think... For me, it's more just that moment you just let everything go. And that's why actually looking out and having your eyes open is very helpful in that, in this particular practice. So there's just a sense of space, but there's no thought with it, and there's no identifying or I should think this or that. It's nothing. It's just nothing. It's just there. So it's really the most bare bones practice. Nothing there. Nothing to do.
But yet it's said to be luminous.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Empty, luminous. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, there'll
That's
be
what
more.
We're going to be exploring.
But
you're going to have a good shot at it.
Good shot. The word flash just means quick.
Quick.
Okay. It's quick.
Mm-hmm. But so, not necessarily what? Quick. I mean, are you saying that you use that type of meditation?
The dedication is very okay.
For an hour? I mean,
no.
Or is it intended to be just a very short?
It's intended to be boom, boom, and then it could be done over and over that way. So it could be more than just that, but just look or just open. And in this case, I think we're saying you can, as Michael Fagan said, have your, you know, be in your meditation room or whatever you're doing, and you could actually start your practice with that if you like, just that moment of resting in space, and then do your shamatha practice, because if you're going to be there for more than a half a second, you should go into your regular practice. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Okay. But are you saying that you might use it during the day as
Yes. So in addition to that, when you get the hang of it or you get a sense of it, it is really good to use like just transition points, like walking through a door, and you just realize there's a transition, or looking out at the sky. You can just take that moment and just have a moment to just open to that space.
Lots of opportunities.
Yeah. So that's actually a practice. So we're introducing new things, which is fun. Okay.
Okay, are we ready?
Yeah.